Yeah, that's a really powerful question.
That's a beautiful question.
That is a very wise question, Lauren.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, speaking with poet Carl Phillips, author of Scattered Snows to the North, and the Pulitzer Prize-winning collection Then the War and Selected Poems, 2007 to 2020. In this conversation, Carl and I discuss the way his poetry reflects and or enacts the subjects he writes about, among them distortion and revelation, memory and vulnerability, regret and its opposite. Carl will be a guest of the University of Montana's MFA Creative Writing Program on Wednesday, November 6th. He's giving a reading at the Missoula Art Museum at 7 p.m. Fact and Fiction will be selling books at the event. Carl, it is my pleasure to be speaking with you in advance of your time in Missoula. Welcome to The Right Question.
Thank you, Lauren, for having me.
I'm hoping that before we begin chatting, you might be willing to read a poem from your newest collection, Scattered Snows to the North. Will you read Before All of This for me?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Here it is. Before all of this. And as usual, early summer seems already to hold inside it the split fruit of late fall, those afternoons whose diminished music will soon enough lie down in, surprised a little, to feel at all surprised. Meanwhile, how the wind sometimes makes the slenderest trees, still young, bend over, makes me think of knowledge conquering superstition. I can almost believe in that until the trees, like fear, spring back. Then a sad sort of quiet just after, as between two people who have finally realized they've stopped regretting the same things. It's like they've never known each other. Yet even now, waking, they insist they've woken from a dream they share, forgetting all over again that every dream is private. Whatever the reasons are for the dead underbranches of the trees that flourish here, that the dead persist is enough. For me, it's enough. The air stirs like history, like the future, like history.
Thank you. Carl, this collection, and certainly this poem specifically, speaks to a relationship between mental and physical landscapes, right? Between memory and seasons, which of course are in conversation with ideas of time. You write about time and risk and recklessness in your 2014 book of essays, The Art of Daring, too. And I'm curious, Carl, what are you willing to risk now in your poetries, in your life, that you weren't perhaps willing to risk when you were younger? And I'm curious further how this book specifically, Scattered Snows to the North, exemplifies that risk-taking.
A hard question to begin with. In terms of the writing, I like to think there's nothing I'm not willing to risk because I think that's what makes for surprise. And the only way for me to discover something new about myself is to try something I haven't tried. I think the easier thing to do, especially the more seasoned a writer you become, is to become relaxed in what you know how to do well. And you have a sense, if you're lucky, that of an audience that has certain expectations. But I've always tried to ignore the idea of audience, and I really do write to sort of stumble into some new way of understanding myself and my body and the world around me. So I guess there's nothing that has changed in that respect. And in life, that's a different story because I think at least the older I get, I think this might be true for people in general. You know, One wants to live longer. So for the risks we took when we were much younger and didn't think about mortality are different. And I'm not likely to take a wild drug that someone hands me just because I think that would be fun to do. And I might have done that in college and not thought about the consequences. So I think that's the challenge of getting older as a human being, is that I do want to still grow and evolve by myself and in my relationship with other people. But at the same time, I don't want to lose everything I've come to care about in my life. So for example, people have affairs and then their whole home life is wrecked forever. But it's also possible that an affair could be the next door to discovering who one is. And so I don't know. I think it's this weird tightrope wire of wanting to sort of still take chances, but also really clinging to the stuff that has become home. That's maybe a roundabout way of answering.
Let's return to this specific idea of time then. I'm curious about how the structure of your poetry, whether that means we begin talking about the sentence or the architecture of the line and its breaks or stanzas, I'm curious about the structure and how it reflects your understanding of time. And you can take that question sort of wherever you want to, because I feel like there might be different ways to respond to that.
Yeah, that's another challenging question. Well, in the poem I just read before all of this, it's sort of laid out. The lines are very irregular in length and they're unpredictable stanza breaks and uses of white space. And I guess that might be a good example of how, first of all, when I lay a poem out on the page, well, first of all, when I'm writing, I think of it as a process of being lost. I like to start from lost and finding my way forward. So I don't know where I'm going and I don't have a set idea of what I'm writing about. And I like the poem to reflect that journey. And that poem in particular that I read, I think does that because they're kind of big steps, you could say, long lines. And then there's a kind of retracting and retracing one's steps and then the pause at the end of a line break. But the pause that you get to at the end of a really long line is different from one that's at the end of a very short line. You haven't journeyed as far in time. And so, in that sense, I feel like there's a tentativeness, a kind of groping slowly forward, sometimes lunging, sometimes taking baby steps. And I guess it takes different amounts of time to do those different types of steps. And sort of wanting to find a way clear, but not rush it, because part of the point is being lost and not what you find, but what happens along the way as you get to what you end up finding for me.
What about the structure of your poetry, as we've been talking about it, I guess, in the way that we're talking about line breaks and sentences? What about the structure of your poetry? What does it say about regret or about its opposite? And I'll quickly add that I'd be curious about your thoughts, Carl, on what the opposite of that is.
The opposite of regret.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to say, by the way, I think these are amazing questions. I never get questions like this. I love this. Well, one of the things about my poems is that they hinge a lot on retracing steps and a lot of self-correction. People have said that one of the most common words in my poems is the word or. And so I'll move forward and sort of make a statement, and then I'll say, oh, or you could think of it this way. Or what if it's really this way and I've been wrong all along? And I think that's an enactment of regret in a way, of sort of saying, well, I feel good about what I did. Do I? Or do I only think that I should feel good? Or do I in fact feel good, but there's something wrong about the fact that I feel that way? And I think my poems work that way, to the frustration of some readers, because I think some people think, why not just make a decision and move forward? But I think when it comes to the big things in life, like relationships and fidelity and things like that, that it's not so straightforward. One of the things I've always been frustrated with is marriage vows suggest you make a promise to stay with somebody forever, but you can only really promise to stay with the person who's right in front of you right now forever. But they're not going to stay that way, and you're not going to stay that way. So how can you say at 25 what at 55 you will think about yourself, let alone this other person? And so I feel as if we have to be careful in making sort of big statements like, I promise this forever. I will remain this way forever. No one remains the same. And I think my poems enact that kind of wanting to move forward in a straight line, but realizing that if you really get precise and look carefully at life, nothing works that way. And there can be a pleasure or a sorrow in that, depending on the context, I suppose. And what the opposite is of regret, I suppose, something like certainty, of knowing for sure I did this and I know it was exactly the right thing to do. But I think it's really hard to, well, it's not always hard to do that. You can say you were angry at somebody, you decide not to kill them, and that seems the right thing, not to kill them. But for example, ending relationships, and you can know that that's the right thing to do for yourself and the other person. But at the same time, you can regret it because it means involving hurting somebody. And how do you reconcile those two things? So I think it's hard to ever be absolutely certain about things. But the older I get, I feel like we incidentally hurt other people no matter what we want to do. All we can hope for is not to purposefully hurt them, but we're going to anyway at some point. And so I think it becomes, to me, it makes it, as I go forward in life, it makes me more tentative about everything because I realize how the simplest decision can have rippling effects on other people's lives.
It's so interesting, Carl, because when I was trying to myself figure out an answer to that question, what is the opposite of regret? I came up with ideas of confidence, which are, is sort of parallel to certainty, or this idea of, I don't know, reflection without judgment of oneself, or I even thought of your poem in this book, Western Edge, which ends with, "Now show me exactly what you think being brave is." So I was kind of contemplating this idea of bravery, perhaps not being an opposite, but certainly in conversation with this opposite of regret and how it fits in line, I think, with queer desire. I feel like I was in different conversations with myself about this question itself, too.
Yeah, I was thinking about what you said about bravery and how I think that poem that you mentioned, I don't know anymore where it came from, but to me now it seems to get at this idea of often people have said to me that I'm brave in various ways. I'm brave as a poet to make statements, or I'm brave in how I've lived my life. And I think that's one way to see it sometimes. And another way to see it is, was I selfish sometimes? Bravery can, making a decision. Let's have a concrete example. So I was in a relationship with somebody for 17 years, man for 17 years, and I realized that we could go around forever and stay together, but we would be circling the same tedious argument forever. And I thought, this is a hard thing to do, but I think I need to leave this relationship. And I did. And many people thought that was a very brave decision. That's, important for your art and blah, blah, blah. But there's a part of me that says, or is the braver thing to stay with somebody and say, well, relationships are work, and maybe circling the same argument is not the worst thing in the world. But for me, it felt as if it was. And I think it has been better for me and for my poems. I don't know that it was better for him. And so I wonder is, and I don't feel I acted out of selfishness, but But it was, certainly was a kind of self-preservation psychologically. So who's to say? And but obviously there can be relationships that are actually quite abusive, and so it's not bravery to stay in them. And it's not failure to leave them in some way. So I don't know. Yeah, there wasn't really a question there, but that idea of bravery interests me, because often people say that to me and I think, oh, I'm just living my life, or I'm just writing this poem. I'm not trying to scandalize anybody. But to them, it looks like bravery.
You're listening to A Conversation with Carl Phillips. I'm Lauren Korn. This episode of The Right Question is supported by Fact and Fiction, an independent bookstore located in the heart of downtown Missoula, Montana, providing books for all ages and supporting the literary community in Montana and beyond. More information can be found at factandfictionbooks.com. Because you'll soon be in Missoula, and Missoula is a river town situated on the Clark Fork River, I'm hoping you would read Sunlight in the Fog.
Okay, here it is. Sunlight in fog. Maybe what a river loves most about the banks that hold it, that appear to hold it, is their willingness or resignation to being mere context for the river's progress or retreat, depending. And maybe how the cattails and reeds thrive there means they prefer a river love. How the river running always away, the way rivers tend to, stands as proof that reliability doesn't have to mean steadfast. How the river itself would say so, if a river could say. I've forgotten entirely what it felt like to enter his body or to be entered by his. But not how he'd spend long afternoons, as if to look away had become impossible, just watching his face get routinely blurred by the river's motion, like an inside-out version, psychologically, of a painting where the model sleeps beneath the portrait of himself not sleeping, if that makes any sense. Not, I mean, that he wasn't capable of love, but that, like history already mistaking itself for myth again, he loved a river.
I want to sort of linger on the phrase, if that makes any sense. You know, because we were talking earlier, you know, just a few minutes ago, about this sort of oscillation that you make in many of your poems, the fact that you use or a lot in your poetry, which to me feels like your processes of thinking kind of laid bare on the page. I'm curious, you may have answered it by talking about this word or putting phrases like, if that makes any sense, into your poems. But I'm curious how you use language, which in your poetry is often pretty spare and very concise, very precise. I'm wondering how that language or your language echoes your processes of thinking on the page.
I mean, I think that's all that poetry is in some ways. It's, for me, an enactment of my thinking in the moment of its happening. I guess I should say that's what I think my poems are, because I think other people, many people, their poems aren't an enactment of live thinking. They're an enactment of highly crafted and thinking that they've thought about ahead of time, which can work in different ways. I mean, obviously, you can't write Dante's Inferno spontaneously. You have to have a plan, I guess. But for me, that is exactly what it is. And it's interesting you mentioned this poem and mentioned that section about if that makes any sense. Because earlier you asked me about risk and ones that I still take. This is an example of a poem where I thought it was a huge risk once I'd done it. Because I thought, you know, Carl, do you yourself know what you mean here? And I worked hard on that comparison of this person sleeping underneath their portrait. And it makes an emotional sense to me, but I can't exactly parse it. And I thought, I don't even know if I could expect a reader to, but as soon as I wrote, if that makes any sense, I thought, leave that there, I thought it's an opening for a reviewer to say, no, it doesn't make any sense. But I thought, but you think it does, Carl, and you acknowledge it may not, but you're also saying you're keeping it there in the poem. I feel like in a workshop, that would be something people would say, revise it away. We agree it doesn't, it's not clear. But I think the work of going inside the simile and trying to sort it out, for me, is the kind of work I like doing as a reader. And so, but it's a risk that someone will just say, this is nonsense. Why should I turn the page? And so in that sense, it's an enactment of thinking, and it's what I stumbled into, and I just decided to trust it. And I also don't think every poem's point is to make sense in terms of being a puzzle that we leave and we unlock it. I think it's, I've been thinking about this a lot lately, that there are a lot of novelists in particular where I read their novels and months later, I can't tell you what happened, but I know how it feels to live inside that particular sensibility. And that kind of atmosphere, I think is, I think it's what I do in my poems, that there's an atmosphere to being in a poem by me. Do people leave and say, well, I know what he writes about, or I remember what this poem exactly was about? Maybe not, but I don't know if that's the point. At least for me anymore as a reader, the point is more, where do I feel like spending time right now? Maybe it's a, in the novels of Banana Yoshimoto, whom I've read many books by her, and I really couldn't tell you what any single one of them is about. But I love them all. And sometimes I just want to go to that land, Banana Yoshimoto land, and that seems enough.
I'm glad you talked about meaning making because that was definitely one of my questions for you, Carl. I want to preface my next question by telling you that I know that you've spoken with a lot of people about this particular collection's organizational structure. But for our listeners to this program who may have yet to scour the internet of all things Carl Phillips related, will you talk about how you've both titled your poems and sections and this collection and how they've been organized? There are repetitions in the titles across the book, but not in a way that a reader might anticipate.
Well, I mean, I guess one thing that I never thought people would pick up on, but apparently they have, is that it's in three sections, this book, and each one has a title, each section. And within the book, there are poems with those titles, but those poems, those titles aren't in the section that is titled that. So that's an example, again, of risk taking. But the usual thing to do is to, whatever the title is of a section, within that section, you'll have a poem called that. But when I was at the very last minute, I decided to mix it up, in part because I had seen how I had originally thought of this book as really three chapbooks in a way. But I started seeing recurring images, like there's a basin of water in one, and then another section, a basin of water that people look at an eclipse in. And ordinarily, I would think those are redundancies and I should try to clean them up a bit. But I also thought it's almost as if, despite my desire to make three chapbooks, these sections want to be stitched together. So they have a separateness, but they also are connected by images. And I thought that doing this titling of the sections would be a way to sort of be another level of stitching sections together. So if you're looking at the section called rehearsal, and you think, where's the poem for rehearsal? It's going to be somewhere at the very end of the book, not where you expected it to be. But at the same time, that means that different sections are speaking to one another. And I decided instead of seeing these as redundancies, you could create an echoing effect that would suggest order in what seems at first like disparate poems. So I guess that's one part of the answer. I mean, in fact, in terms of titling individual poems, who knows? That is the hardest part for me and comes much later than when I've written the poems usually. And so often, well, and another example, Why So This Quiet? That title is actually a line from a poem in an actual chapbook I did in 2019, I think. I've for years now been, when stuck for a title, I'll go to one of my earlier books and I'll pick a line from or a phrase from another poem and make it the title of my latest poem. And at first I didn't know. I mean, that was just a desperate way to have a title. But now I kind of like how I've created this choiring effect. And for those who, I don't expect people to remember isolated fragments from my earlier books or something. But if anyone were to study it, they'd think, "Oh, I see, this is familiar." And even though I didn't write the latest poem to speak to something older, by connecting it to the older poem, it sort of reinforces a connection, which to me makes sense because, I think of all the books as one long extended meditation, lifelong meditation that eventually will end, of just one person being in the world. And so why shouldn't those things be connected in the way we carry with us? Like, I'm 65, but inside me is still the 12-year-old that remembers vividly where I was at 12. And, or there's the, traumatized 25-year-old. We carry all those older selves with us. So it seems to make sense that each book would also, in some way, we're carrying something over from our older, our earlier selves. I think it sounds more systematic when I put it that way, but that's more or less what I think I've been doing.
I think that's the perfect segue to one of my last requests of you, Carl. I'm hoping that you'll read a poem outside of this newest collection, but that speaks, I think, to many of the concerns of this collection. Will you read Not the Waves as They Make Their Way Forward, which again is collected in Then the War, but was originally published in Wild as the Wind?
Yeah. Not the waves as they make their way forward. Like Virgil, Marcus Aurelius died believing that his triumphs, when pitched against his failures, had come to very little. I don't know. Given the messiness of most lives, humble, legendary, all the rest in between, their interiors, I mean, it's hard to say he was wrong. Black night, black train, freight of worries, things that stay the same. Having reached that point that even the luckiest sometimes never get close to, where desire at last offers nothing more nor less than what restraint can, Marcus Aurelius wrote down some thoughts meant apparently only for himself, though they became Meditations, a book without which, by now, he'd pretty much be forgotten. It begins with gratitude. How it ends is painful, if I'm remembering right. But it isn't pain.
That was poet Carl Phillips, author of Scattered Snows to the North and the Pulitzer Prize-winning collection Then the War and Selected Poems, 2007 to 2020. Carl will be a guest of the University of Montana's MFA Creative Writing Program on Wednesday, November 6th. He's giving a reading at the Missoula Art Museum at 7 p.m. Fact and Fiction will be selling books at this event. To learn more about Carl, go to mtpr.org, where you can also listen to this conversation again or share it with friends. You've been listening to The Right Question. This episode was produced by me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. The artwork for The Right Question was designed by Molly Russell. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008. And thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.